Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about political correctness. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest, Associate Professor of Church-State Studies and Associate Director of the Institute for Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. He's also authored the book Politically Correct Death. We're talking about political correctness. Now, I'd like to hear from you in just a moment, but first, one of the reasons that we do programs like this is we're talk radio for the thinking Christian. Part and parcel of thinking is reading. It really does help someone think, not only objectively, but critically. It's different than just listening to the radio or watching television or having a conversation. Reading requires critical thinking. That's why we have Issues Etc. Books of the Month. Now, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month this month, it's called They Will See His Face. Richard Iyer is its author and a regular guest here on the program. It's about worship and healing. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can browse before you buy. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on and an image of They Will See His Face. When you call or when you write, make sure you mention Issues Etc. It's our book of the month called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. Now, I want to hear from you on how you have encountered political correctness in your life. Our studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Joe's up first. He's calling from St. Louis. Joe, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. I'm wondering, can I get that book of the month on video? It would make it a lot easier for me.
No, we do not offer books of the month on video. We do require reading, yes.
Okay. Anyway, the way I have encountered political correctness, I'm an attorney, and I was dealing with an attorney out of town about some issues with how data entry was done relating to a house loan. And the attorney out of town says to me, well, we can't access that information or it's not updated quickly because it's sent out to India where the data entry people are. And so when I was in court on this matter, I mentioned from the podium to the judge that, you know, that the data entry was done in India, you know, then that was their reason for not being able to update the information. And I was admonished from the podium that that was irrelevant and warned basically that where the data entry was done had nothing to do with it. And I told the judge that that's what the other attorney told me. That was their excuse, not mine.
Yeah.
And I can only assume that it's because I was somehow maligning Indians or something. I'm not sure what I was doing. I didn't think I was doing anything, but I was stopped immediately that I couldn't even say that.
Joe, thank you very much for that story, and thank you for the call. A hypersensitivity here, Dr. Beckwith?
I think so. I mean, you know, one of the, you know, this is, I think, a real delicate matter, because on the one hand, we do want to be sensitive to people, that we don't insult them unnecessarily, and that we are aware of what affects people. On the other hand, though, we don't want to nurture a culture in which people become so attuned to anything that may offend them that they actually then hold their fellow citizens hostage in every interaction or any activity. So, for instance, let me give you an example from my own experience. When I was teaching at University of Nevada, I used the word Indian in class, and one of my students said, got very upset. He said, "Well, it's Native American." And then another one of my students said, who happened to be Native American, "I'd like to be called an Indian." And they wound up getting into an argument with each other over what to call each other, and it was so absurd that I intervened and I said, "Look, one of the things that you should remember that when you're encountering other people, never first assume that your first reaction is correct, because oftentimes it's not the fault of the person speaking, it's sometimes the fault of the listener. And we shouldn't always interpret people's comments in the most negative way possible. Sometimes people just say things differently than us. And so in kind of a weird way, what we've done is we've we've created intolerant people in the name of tolerance. We've made people so sensitive that now none of us can really feel free to speak because we will always be assumed as having bad motives or being insensitive. And I think that's ultimately harmful to relationships between people.
We're talking about the way that political correctness fails, and we mentioned in the previous segment that it is self-refuting in so many of its statements and its credos. Another way that you say it fails is that it begs the question. It assumes what it purports to prove. Tell us about it.
Well, for example, supposing somebody says to you, you ought to be tolerant of all points of view. And of course, what they're claiming, though, is the point of view that you're asserting is not one of those points of view that should be tolerated. And so instead of actually defending their particular way of looking at the world, they just assume it's correct and then claim that you lack virtue because you don't happen to agree with it. And so in a way, they beg the question. That is, the question is that particular understanding of what's good, true, and beautiful the correct one? Now, they don't argue for it. They assume it's right and then use that to inflict judgment upon you. I mean, I think the best example is the case of gay rights and same-sex marriage. One particular example that I'll just use from my own experience, I recently published a piece on National Review Online in which I suggested that conservatives should go up to the Bay Area when this mayor was issuing marriage licenses for same-sex couples and try to get married with all sorts of other arrangements. For example, three men, let's say two brothers, a polygamous relationship, and see what the mayor would do. Would he issue licenses? I suspect he wouldn't. But then you would ask him, well, what are the grounds for not issuing the license? And he'd have to give you the grounds. He'd have to give you the reasons. What he had been doing before, though, is simply assuming the correctness of his position and never being challenged. So he would say something like, well, people should have a right to marry any partner they want. Well, that's simply not true. I can't marry my neighbor's wife. I can't marry my sister. I can't marry my brother. All sorts of things. I can't marry myself. In fact, that was one of the arrangements that I suggested in my article. And if somebody said, well, you can't marry yourself, you need more than one person, just accuse them of a new prejudice, numberism, the view that one must have more than one or at least one spouse. And of course, that's silly. What this individual, this mayor, was doing is simply assuming his position correct and then issuing judgments. And I think what we have to do, those of us who hold to more traditional views of marriage and human sexuality, is to start being the skeptic, start acting like people act in response to our beliefs, start requiring that they defend their point of view, that they give us reasons. I mean, there's no rule out there that says that we must always be the ones defending our beliefs. It's a lot more fun, by the way, to be the skeptic.
And it does not hurt our position to have it challenged. And if ours will be challenged and we welcome the challenge, shouldn't those who advocate political correctness also welcome the challenge to their position?
They should. And I think that when we're in that situation in which we have an opportunity to challenge them and they tell us not to challenge them, we should appeal to the values they always appeal to: open-mindedness, believing in diversity, being open to alternative points of view, being tolerant. These are judgments that are continually issued against cultural conservatives. And yet, when we want to offer our point of view in the public square, oftentimes we're shouted down and told to leave. This is not unusual on college campuses where speakers who are more conservative are shouted down by supposed liberal students. And it's a disgrace. And so I think that what we have to do is be a little bit more confident and employ the resources of the political correct types themselves. And you're perfectly correct. We have to not be afraid of a challenge to our faith or even our political or social beliefs. I think they can pass muster and they stand rather well. On the other hand, though, I think that Christians have gotten used to being on the defensive, and so it's once in a while it's not bad to just fire back.
Are the politically correct, while they accuse the rest of us of being narrow and close-minded, are they in fact of guilty of precisely the same thing?
I think they are, and let me give you an example of a case about 12 years ago now. My sister, who is now an actress in the Hollywood and a stand-up comedian, she was taking a class at a Catholic high school in Nevada where we grew up, and the teacher began the semester by saying that students should not should be open-minded at all points of view because nobody has the truth on religion and morality. And my sister raised her hand, and she said, well, if nobody has the truth on religion and morality, isn't that a good reason not to listen to anybody else? I mean, after all, only if somebody has the truth does it make sense for me to be open-minded. The motivation for being open-minded is that I can learn something, but you're saying that there is nothing to learn, that there is no truth. And the teacher was very upset about this, and my sister, who had talked to me about this in the past, made the point to the other students that what the teacher was suggesting was not really open-mindedness, but was a type of closed-mindedness, that there was no view of truth that was correct except relativism. And this typically happens in high school and college environments in which relativism is offered as a antidote to closed-mindedness, when it in fact is telling students there is no truth, there's only one way to look at this, and that's relativism. And that turns out to be a narrow-minded position.
And you observe, in fact, you quote Alan Bloom from The Closing of the American Mind, talking about students that cannot defend viewpoints or opinions in a mark that they have been thoroughly indoctrinated. They simply, as you said before, spout the slogans and are stupefied when someone doesn't agree with them.
That's correct. Yeah, they just simply assert the position as correct, and they don't actually think it through. When I was at the University of Nevada, one of my students who was very upset at my attacks on political correctness asked me, Dr. Beckwith, why is the truth important? And I responded to her, well, do you want the true question or the do you want the true answer or the false one? And she was stupefied. She didn't know what to say. And the point of the response was that by asking the question, why is the truth important, you're assuming it is important. You wouldn't be asking the question unless you wanted me to give you the right answer. And so a lot of times students come to the university with these slogans, thinking they know everything and that they're enlightened. And it turns out that they've never heard any critical comments against it. And they're sort of shocked that their professor may very well not agree with them.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that in the name of tolerance, we have created intolerant people, and many have observed that the definition of tolerance has radically shifted in the last 30 years or so. What does it mean now? Mm-hmm. What did it used to mean?
Good question. It used to mean tolerance, and I still think a lot of people still hold this view, and that is tolerance means that we ought to be concerned about other people. That is to say, we should treat people with respect, we should treat them decently, and we should treat them in a way that honors the image of God in them. But that is not the same as saying that we should agree with everything they say. In fact, tolerance presupposes that I, at least the traditional way, tolerance in this traditional notion presupposes that I think that I'm right and the other guy is wrong. I can only be tolerant of people I think are mistaken. I'm not tolerant of people that I agree with. I agree with them. I don't tolerate them. I think that they're right. But people I disagree with, I'm tolerant of them insofar as I permit them to speak, I listen to them, I try to learn something from them, and I still may come away thinking that they're wrong. But tolerance is really only a virtue if you think the other person is wrong. On the other hand, today, tolerance is used as a type of club to make people feel embarrassed for believing that they're right, which is weird because tolerance is always presupposed that you believe that you're right. Because the only way you can be tolerant is if you think the other guy's wrong. Now it means making a judgment is intolerant. And so I give you an example of the, from my own experience. Years ago, I was on a radio show, and a guy called up, and he said, "You're intolerant because you're judging homosexuality as immoral." And I said, "Well, why is that intolerant?" He said, "Well, it's wrong to judge other people." I said, "Well, then quit judging me." And he said, "Well," he said, "I'm not judging you." I said, "Really? You think I'm wrong?" "Yes." I said, "That's a judgment." And so he couldn't get out of this appalling loop that he had gotten himself into, because he had already defined tolerance as not making a judgment. But in order to say that, he had to make a judgment. And so what really is going on is this. This fellow, as well as a number of other people, believe that they're right, and they use tolerance as a type of wedge to silence people. And they don't mean it in the traditional sense.
You've mentioned several times the role of political correctness in the changing views of marriage, of the new term of art, gender. It used to be sex, I think.
Yeah.
And I even read today about a school code in the state of California where children are allowed just to define their own genders, and there's a school district that's actually saying, no, this is nonsense. What happens when it's not only in the culture, but it's in the church, in particular, the church leading the way in some cases on the whole issue of redefining gender in marriage?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are some trends within the Christian church that I find to be disturbing. I recently came across some things on the internet, actually forwarded to me by a friend of mine, Greg Kokel, who I believe has been on your radio show. He's my co-author on the relativism book. And what's troubling is that some of these ministries are embracing relativism as a way to supposedly attract people to the church, to say that Christianity is true, is to buy into, this is their view, is to buy into an enlightenment notion of truth. What we should do is simply show that we are a community of love, and people become attracted to the gospel. Now, I don't dispute that we should be a community of love. We should be Christ-like. But ultimately, our faith is contingent upon whether the events of Jesus' life really happened and whether there is a God. And people do sometimes want to have answers to these questions, and they simply cannot be answered by whether our community acts in a Christ-like way. I mean, it ought to, and it ought to be attractive. We should be ambassadors that attract people to the gospel, but ultimately the gospel's truth is not contingent upon how well we act. It's ultimately contingent upon the person of Christ and who he is. So some of these trends in the church are attempts to take things from postmodernism and political correctness and sort of make it, user-friendly, so to speak. And some of it is good, but I think that we have to be very careful in the way we use this and not forget that our faith is not about always assimilating the culture, but to understand the culture, respond to the culture what we have to, incorporate things from the culture that are consistent with Christianity, but be very, very careful in the way that we do it.
It seems as though if it can infect the church, it can infect any institution. I mean, obviously, some institutions have welcomed it with open arms, but I've heard arguments lately in the church that would put the same kind of the old term was thought police.
Yeah,
but the same kind in service of the culture. In particular, I'm thinking about the Episcopal Church USA.
Yeah.
That has said, look, if you don't accept Gene Robinson as an openly gay bishop as something that ought to happen in the church, you are obviously guilty to one degree or another of intolerance or not being accepting of people who are different from yourselves. It's simply drawn in lines of you're this way, someone else is different from you, you can't tolerate difference.
Yeah, and you're right. That's the way the liberals in the Episcopal Church are framing it. But the question I would ask them is, would they apply the same standard to somebody who held racist views? I mean, imagine if there was a bishop that was beloved, somebody who, let's say, behaved in a way that was not unkind, but actually held, let's say, white supremacist opinions. That is, they believed that white people were superior than other races, treated people of all races kindly, but just thought believed in white supremacy and wrote on it and published it. I mean, would we be hearing from the liberals in the Episcopal Church, look, this is just one particular lifestyle among many, we ought to be tolerant to all points of view? Clearly wouldn't hear that. Why? Because there are some things that simply should not be tolerated because they're inconsistent with Scripture, no matter how nice a person may be able to portray those views or even defend them, and no matter how kind they are, no matter how loving they appear to be. I mean, the thing about Robinson, which is particularly disturbing, is that he left his wife for another a relationship. I mean, can you imagine if it were a heterosexual bishop who went off with the church secretary? Do you think he'd be let back in? I mean, there's almost, in the Episcopal Church, a special category for adultery, that somehow homosexual adultery is not as bad as heterosexual adultery. So, you know, I'm speaking as somebody who is Episcopal, so that's why I'm particularly animated about this. But it's quite amazing.
With only 1 minute here, you said it was a waning fad. You believe it is. What's at stake in the battle, as long as it lasts, in the ongoing battle against political correctness? 1 minute, Frank.
Yeah, I think that in terms of what it means for the Christian church, and I think we have to remember that our theology is part of a knowledge tradition. That is, when we say that Christianity is true and that the deliverances of Scripture are in fact true, we mean that those things can count against anything in secular trends or supposed secular knowledge, and that secular knowledge could support these deliverances of Scripture as well. And so I think one of the things we have to be careful about in terms of any trend in intellectual movement, whether it's political correctness or something else, is that we have to take the good with the bad and always test it against our theological tradition. I think one of the things that that Christians have generally abandoned is the understanding of our theology as being something that we know, not merely something that we believe. And as long as we treat it as something subjective, we're going to fall prey to things like political correctness, and we're going to feel, well, this is just my belief. No, it's not just our belief. We actually believe it's true, and that's different from a subjective preference.
Dr. Frank Beckwith, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thanks for having me.
Dr. Frank Beckwith. Folks, if you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to help Issues Etc. defend the truth in an age of anti-truth by making a tax-deductible gift, our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, 1-800-737-0172. Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Why do you go to church? To thank and praise God? To get some spiritual motivation for a weary work week? To obey God's command, remember the Sabbath day? But is worship primarily about what we do, or is it about God's service to us? Worship is the subject of our Issues Etc. book of the month for April. They Will See His Face. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. They Will See His Face costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. You can also order this book online at issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. They Will See His Face is a must-read for the worship wars. 1-800-325-3040. or issuesetc.org. They will see his face, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Young Earth, it's a heresy?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the fascinating book, The Dinosaurs of Eden. Well, Ken, that's kind of incredible. What would make someone think that it's actually a heresy to believe that God created a young earth?
Well, I have to admit that I was a bit shocked. We received a letter recently calling us heretics because we say the earth's about 6,000 years old. Now, this person argued that radioactive dating proves the earth's over 4 billion years old. So we're calling God a liar if we say that he made the earth 6,000 years ago. But what's the problem with the argument? Well, this critic believed that radiometric dating gives absolute dates. However, there are hundreds of different ways to date the earth, and each method is based on fallible assumptions and thus give different ages. For instance, radioactive zircon crystals in the earth's crust have produced a whole bunch of helium atoms that should have escaped into the atmosphere. Based on recent research, this means the earth's only about 6,000 years old. So why not accept this date? You know, this critic won't, because he believed in billions of years before he even looked at the facts. The language of the Bible is clear. The earth's about 6,000 years old. Rather than making God a liar by believing in an old earth, Christians should believe what the Bible says. The earth's about 6,000 years old.
Ken Ham's free booklet on the 6 days of creation will help you defend your faith, even with compromising Christians. Just go to our attractive website, answersradio.com, and read Ken's booklets there.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. A study published by the International Journal of Eating Disorders found that the amount of time an adolescent watches soaps, movies, and music videos is directly associated with their degree of body dissatisfaction and a desire to be thin. So we should not be surprised that 40% of America's 9-year-old girls have tried to lose weight. Popular media have increasingly held up a thinner and thinner body image as the ideal for girls. If you have a young girl at home, remind her that Jesus loves her just the way she is. She does not need to be thin as a rail to be accepted by those who love her most, her real friends, her family, and most of all, her Lord Jesus. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
When you behold the things of God, do you see clearly, do you see dimly, or are you blind? We talked about seeing clearly in the context of Mark chapter 8 earlier today on our Bible study program with Pastor John Lukomsky. If you'd like to hear that program, we'll repeat it tonight at 7:05. The Bible Study Repeat.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. We'll be talking with Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, during these 25 minutes. Well, the stories from Iraq come fast and furious, and with every hour, it seems another development. This weekend brought some developments as well. We talked about it during Open Lines, during, the second half hour of the program, on into the 4:30 line. We were talking about that, the city of Najaf, a holy city, a shrine there in Najaf that is being now, at this point at least, inhabited as a sanctuary by one of the bad men up to no good in Iraq. What do you do? We'll be talking about that during these 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Islam and the war in Iraq. Have we underestimated or misestimated Islam, and therefore we are perhaps not waging war the way we ought to in Iraq? Robert Spencer is director of Jihad Watch, author of the books Onward Muslim Soldiers and Islam Unveiled. Robert, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
First of all, your reaction to the events that have been unfolding for about the last 10 days in Iraq?
Well, it's something that I was sure was going to happen all along, and that is a reaction and an action by the people who believe that Islam is a political system as well as an individual faith, and that the only legitimate government for Iraq can be constituted according to Islamic law. Excuse me. So that you are now seeing them making their move.
Can you describe for those of us who are not conversant in the nuances and the differences in the various sects of Islam, What's going on here? Why is it significant that we have a Shiite cleric in a Shiite holy city at a Shiite shrine who is essentially thumbing his nose and waging war from that position in Najaf?
Well, the Shiites are the group that runs Iran are Shiites, and they are the second largest sect in Islam, although they're actually quite small compared to the Sunnis, who constitute about 85 to 90% of all Muslims worldwide. But they are a group, as I say, the group that is the group that runs Iran, and that means that it's a cause for very great concern, because the Shiites also constitute a majority in Iraq. And so to have the Shiites rising up in Iraq and to have Muqtada as-Sadr leading them with the explicit approval of the Iranians is evidently a bid by Iran to try to gain control of Iraq.
Something I heard a lot over the weekend, and that was speculation that the Sunni minority and the Shiite majority, at least in northern Iraq, near the Sunni triangle, have somehow found common cause now together, that Sunnis
yes.
and Shiites are cooperating. Is that your estimation as well?
Yes, I've seen indications to that effect, and that doesn't surprise me either. Even though they have quite a lot of animosity toward one another, they will always unite against an external threat. And so it seemed to me to be only a matter of time before you would see Sunnis and Shiites uniting to try to get rid of the Americans.
What is the role, let's talk about Muqtada al-Sadr, if we could, as a cleric. He's called a cleric.
Yes.
What is his role as a cleric in Islam, and then in particular among the Shiites in Iraq?
Well, he's a religious leader, a teacher. He corresponds to a minister or a priest in Christianity. He does, obviously, he doesn't perform the same kinds of functions, because Islam is a different kind of religion. But he is a very much a religious leader, and it's not just that he is a religious leader who happens to be dabbling in politics, but he is considering what he's doing to be part and parcel of his responsibilities as a Muslim cleric, because of his conviction that Islam is a political as well as what we would consider to be a religious thing. In other words, there's no sacred secular distinction in Islam.
So are we watching, it's being characterized in the press often as a nationalistic insurrection or uprising. Is this nationalist?
No.
This an Iraq thing or an Islam thing?
I would say it's very much an Islamic thing. That especially because of the participation of Iran from one side and Syria from the other, that they have an interest in Iraq not only to enhance their position within the Middle East, their respective positions in the Middle East, but also because this is coming out of the Islamic principles that the religion transcends national boundaries, and that to come to the service of fellow Muslims for the sake of the larger Muslim ummah, the community worldwide, is something that all Muslims have the responsibility to do.
I also wanted your reaction, and we just heard at the bottom of the hour another news update about more mutilated bodies found in Iraq, although the details were rather sparse, but we did have that gruesome story that was flashed all over
yeah.
the world and the pictures as well, of not only the killings, but the mutilations of coalition civilians. And it was roundly criticized. The mutilations were criticized, but the
yes.
killings themselves were not. What do we make of that?
Well, in the first place, that's because Islamic law allows for the killing of civilians even if they're not directly fighting against you, because if they're considered to be aiding in the war effort, then they're fair game. The mutilations were condemned, not the killings. However, excuse me, the fact is that some Islamic clerics have pointed out that Islamic law allows for these kinds of actions in retaliation. And so you have some Muslim groups who are considering that what they're doing is retaliating against the Americans and trying to strike terror into the hearts of the unbelievers, which is what the Quran directs them to do. And thus they are going to be performing actions of this kind.
President George W. Bush, on several occasions, although I would say not so much lately, has characterized Islam as a religion of peace.
Yes.
Has he misjudged Islam?
Drastically. The fact is that even the most radical Muslims who teach that Islam, that Muslims in general, the Muslim community worldwide, has the responsibility to wage war against unbelievers for the sake of the religion, even they will say that the
religion is a religion of peace, but the peace that they envision is the peace that will come from the obedience to Islamic law, the Sharia, and nothing else short of that is peace, and that in order to institute that peace, Muslims must fight. And so it's a very different idea of peace to start with from what we are used to. And then for him to say that is just is dangerously misleading, and puts us at risk of underestimating the extent of what we're up against, as well as misjudging the sources of where this kind of jihad terrorism are coming from. Because obviously we're not going to be looking in the mosques of a religion of peace for people who are inciting this thing, although there's abundant evidence that that's exactly where terrorists are being recruited.
Tell us about this holy city, listed in the press today as the third holiest of the shrines in Islam, third only to Mecca and Medina, Najaf, and the shrine at which Muqtada al-Sadr has taken up his refuge.
Well, this is something that he's done by design, because he is trying to claim for himself the mantle of all the Shiites, and to portray himself as being the standard bearer for all the Shiites, and by extension also of all the Muslims in Iraq. And so he is very, very calculatedly taking up his position there, precisely because of the religious significance of the place.
So is he seeking to create kind of a no-win situation for the coalition forces? If they go in and kill him, they desecrate a holy city, a shrine, and a holy man, that the ruins stand as a monument to him and to the Shiite cause. If they do nothing, he, in a sense, wins the argument by default over the coalition forces.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what he's trying to do, is come out with a victory either way, and come out with a victory even if he's killed, then he's a martyr. And positioning his conflict specifically in religious terms, and explicitly and repeatedly in religious terms, makes it even more likely that he's trying to set up that kind of a situation.
To the Western mind, in particular, to kind of the Western mind so heavily influenced by Christianity and its thought, the claims, the religious claims, the religious terms in which this is framed by clerics like Muqtada al-Sadr seem disingenuous to us, because they seem to make religious claims. What they really want is political power. You said very early in our conversation that in Islam that distinction does not exist.
Yes, and so they're not being hypocritical or being actually they're untrue to their principles. They're actually being quite true to their principles, because Islam is a very different kind of faith from Christianity, and I think this is one of the things that has eluded most analysts, because they assume that if it's a religion, then it must be pretty much constituted the way people think of religions in the West. But Islam has a political dimension, and always has, that the Western religions don't have, and that has made all the difference here and continues to do so.
Apart from the fact, of course, that coalition forces have been for more than a year inside Iraq and have, for good or for ill, have done their task pretty admirably, but they're going to be there for a while, at least by everyone's estimates. Aside from that big fact, why do Muslims in particular in Iraq, and then elsewhere in the Islamic world, why do they seem to appear to hold so much animus against the Western world and against the United States in particular?
Well, this all goes together with everything that we've been saying today, as a matter of fact, because it comes from the idea that Islam is a political and social system as well as an individual faith, such that people who come in and try to institute democracy in the Islamic world are actually seen to be enemies of the religion, who are trying to destroy Islam because they're trying to neutralize this that is seen to be an all-important, innocent, absolutely essential and inseparable aspect of it, and that is the political aspect. And so by going in and saying, we're here to give you democracy and freedom, a lot of people hear that and say, oh, they're trying to destroy Islam, and we have to fight them.
So we talk about the establishment of a secular democracy, as secular as things can be. Is that a pipe dream?
Well, I think that it's certainly going to be an uphill battle, to say the least, because you're battling against deeply entrenched ideas of how the society ought to be constituted that come out of Islam and that view democracy as a foreign import that is not welcome and not needed, and that there's no tradition of democracy in that part of the world. But that's not even the problem. Other places where there have been no tradition of democracy, democracies have established and thrived. The problem is that you have this competitor and in the form of political Islam that has not been discredited and has not been rejected by the majority of the people there. And so they're going to keep coming and fighting. The obvious comparison that the president has made many times is the situation in Germany and Japan after the war, World War II. And he said, look, people said democracy couldn't work there, and it did. But after World War II in Germany, nobody was going to stand up and say, yes, I'm a Nazi and I'm proud and we ought to reestablish a Nazi government. And nobody in Japan was going to reestablish state Shinto after the emperor himself had renounced it. But nobody's renounced political Islam. On the contrary, it's stronger than ever. And so this is going to be a ferocious competitor and obstacle to establishing any democracy there.
Robert Spencer is our guest. We're talking about Islam and the war with Iraq. He's director of Jihad Watch and author of the books Onward Muslim Soldiers and Islam Unveiled. So realistically, what do you expect to see 2, 3, 5 years from now in Iraq?
That depends on what kind of a commitment the United States is willing to make. And this doesn't even necessarily involve our staying in the country. We could withdraw our troops from the country and make it very clear in no uncertain terms that there is not going to be tolerated any kind of anti-American government there or any kind of a Sharia Islamic law system that oppresses non-Muslims and women. But that will require enforcement, and that just depends on our level of commitment. Otherwise, if we say, well, we're going to leave this to the people's self-determination, then it's very possible that we'll end up with an Islamic State after the model of Iran.
And if Muqtada al-Sadr in some way finds himself on the wrong end of a gun barrel in the next several weeks and he's no longer a problem, his Mehdi army and militia are gone, will there be someone else to take his place?
Well, I'm just not so sure that his army would be gone if he were killed. And that the problem that you have is that this is not, even though they're waving around his picture and so on, we would be dangerously naive to think that this is a cult of personality that will collapse if he's gone. This is something that's based on religious principles, and because those religious principles will continue, will endure after his death or his capture, we're going to see the same thing. Yes, somebody else is going to step forward. We've already seen Sistani and the others that we thought we could count on now saying that they're not going to let anything happen to him.
You said earlier that some of the basic elements of what Islam really is, the failure to distinguish between religious beliefs and political beliefs, you say that that distinction, or that lack of a distinction, is lost on many analysts. Do you believe it's lost on those who are conducting the war in Iraq?
A lot of them, yeah, absolutely. I think that that's been clear. Been made clear by how they've conducted it. On the other hand, there are some encouraging signs. We did see Bremer and Rumsfeld saying they weren't going to tolerate an Islamic State in Iraq, and I hope they follow through with that. Remains to be seen.
Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Herman, who's calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Mr. Spencer if, beyond the locality of the area we're talking about and the political faith of Islam in its essence, does he see these elements being strong enough to come together and actually get enough military force to do a classical across-the-seas invasion of United States shores where fanatical Muslim troops are landing, waving AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades all over the coast of the United States to conquer it?
I don't think that's at all on the radar screen, no. What is much more likely is that, I mean, we shouldn't make no mistake, there are radical Muslims who want to conquer any place they can, including the United States, and would especially like to neutralize the United States because it's the chief competitor to their vision of the world being put under the sway of Islamic law. But it's much more likely to happen from within, and that is from the fact that the United States has its guard down in general, is not aware of the source of the problem, as I discussed before, and will not be on its guard against those who are trying to subvert the nation. It's much more likely that it'll happen in that way than from a classic invasion.
Is Islam incompatible with democracy, either as we've talked about, the possibility of a secular democracy in Iraq, or in terms of international affairs, an Islamic state dealing with liberal democracies?
Well, there is, a liberal democracy in the Islamic world, and that's Turkey. It's been there for about 80 years now. But we must recall that it was founded in the atmosphere of war with Islam, that Kemal Ataturk founded it on explicitly Western principles and on the explicit rejection of the political elements of Islam. Now, that means that there's never been an organically created democracy in the Islamic world. Could there be one sometime? I wouldn't rule it out. But there's certainly going to be significant forces within the Islamic world at all times that will resist those kinds of developments on the basis of saying that these things must not stand and that they're against Islam.
Knowing what you know about the situation in Iraq, knowing what you know in general about Islam, what and when do you believe this situation, what, when, and how do you believe the situation is resolved?
There's no real resolution to this because you're dealing with people who are fighting what they consider to be a war that has lasted for 1,400 years, that it's part of the global jihad, and that it began with the jihads of the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century. Now, you take that kind of mindset and the idea that we're going to fight to institute the law of Allah or die trying, then how do you deal with people like that? The only way you can deal with them is from a position of strength and understand that the stronger that you appear and the less likely to appease or to go along with what to turn a blind eye to their activities, then the less likely they are to gain successes, and they need success. If they fail, then God is not allowing them to win, and there's something wrong with what they're doing, and they're going to go back. They'll retreat. This has happened again and again in history. They won't give up, and they won't go away entirely, but they won't be bothering us. If, however, we show the face of appeasement, like Bill Clinton did, intentionally or not, when he withdrew the troops from Somalia after the Black Hawk incident, he showed Osama bin Laden that we were the weak horse, as Osama himself explained, that we were ripe for the taking because we didn't have the will to fight. And the more we give that impression, the more fights we're going to have on our hands.
Very quickly, a couple questions. It seems as though Israel has taken a rather hard line in varying degrees at various times against Islamic forces, not all Islamic, but majority Islamic forces in their own borders. Has it benefited them?
Well,
there are many who would argue they're for appeasement.
Yeah, I think the same thing is true there, that when they showed a willingness to negotiate with terrorists and to allow people who had committed terrorist acts to come to the negotiating table, they emboldened their opponents, and that this is, you have to stand firm altogether. That's the only thing that's ever been shown to work.
Is Islam a religion ready-made for terrorism?
It is a religion that has a developed doctrine, theology, and law that mandates violence against unbelievers. Most Muslims don't act on that, and we can thank God for that. However, those are the elements that are being exploited by the terrorists and are used to justify their actions. And as long as those elements are not rejected by the vast majority of Muslims, we're going to see more and more of this.
Finally, you've written, "The culture of tolerance threatens to render the West incapable of drawing reasonable distinctions. The general reluctance to criticize any non-Christian religion and the almost universal public ignorance about Islam make for a lethal mix.
Yeah.
What do you mean, and how do you apply it to today's situation with the war in Iraq?
It's a lot of what we've been discussing today, as a matter of fact, that Islam being considered to be a religion of peace, people are reluctant on the basis of civil rights concerns, and I'm all for preserving all civil rights that are granted by the Constitution, but I don't think it violates anyone's civil rights to go into the mosques and simply to pay attention to what's going on and what's being taught in them. And that until we do that and take other similar measures to that work from the assumption that we know that these are recruiting grounds for terrorists, the terrorists are going to continue to recruit. But as long as we turn a blind eye and say this is fundamentally benign because it is a religion and religions are fundamentally benign, then they're going to keep on acting with impunity within the Islamic religious communities, and that will be to our ultimate detriment.
And how do you respond very briefly to the person who says one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter? Muqtada al-Sadr is simply looking to have his people free and out from under the thumb of Western oppression.
Well, I know that the Western oppressors that he despises would like nothing better than to get out of there. And so that's one thing. There's a certain kind of cognitive dissonance there. If this were really a war for oil, we could have kept the oil after the first Gulf War, but we gave it back. And this was no accident. The fact is that Muqtada al-Sadr is someone who is working from, as I've explained, fundamentally religious principles, and he's going to keep coming no matter what we're doing. The fact is that what he's saying is something that's said by other groups all around the world, many places where there's no American presence whatsoever, like Kashmir, Mindanao, Indonesia, and other places like that. And so I think it would be myopic to say that this is something that simply has to do with American actions. It didn't start with American actions in Iraq, and it won't end with them.
Folks, check out Robert Spencer's website tonight at jihadwatch.org. That's jihadwatch.org, jihadwatch.org. Robert Spencer, thank you for being our guest.
All right, thank you.
Robert Spencer is director of Jihad Watch, author of the books Onward Muslim Soldiers and Islam Unveiled. This is something that all of us should bear in mind because, and I believe our guest is correct, if he is correct, this is something that is not simply going to appear on the radar screen today or next week or 2 years from now and then eventually fade away. One thing is certain, dealing with international Islam is going to be on the radar screen for the foreseeable future. This is a situation that was a long time coming. We may have not seen it coming, but it is here and here to stay. We need to realize that this is not only a religion, but a religion that does not distinguish between religion and politics. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.